Thank you, Mitch. Peace and support. My name is Jack Carnegie. I represent the relator of the Crown Central Petroleum and Crown Central Pipeline. The issue before the court is whether the trial court erred in ordering the imposition of Crown Central's chief executive officer when he has no knowledge of relevant facts and less intrusive methods of discovery have not been exhausted or, in large part, even attempted, and further, without placing any limitations on the scope or duration of that deposition.
Counsel, have you made any written response to the March 21st supplemental response by U.S. parties of interest?
I have not made a written response to that, Your Honor.
But if it's true, if it is true that this case at one time might have settled on these terms, it's your position it won't settle now, that this matter at any rate won't settle now and terms out by interior.
I'm sorry about settlement.
Well, at least the impression I got from reading this is that one time you were willing to produce Mr. Rosenberg in Houston. Now the real parties in interest are willing to do that, but that is no longer a viable option.
I think that is a little misconstruction of the correspondence, Your Honor. What the correspondence is talking about is just the location of his deposition, if the deposition is ultimately ordered to go forward, not whether we are actually willing to produce him, because we're not. That, of course, is why we're here.
Maybe I just got a little over up.
There was some limitation on the length of the deposition.
They have said that they didn't anticipate the deposition would take more than 3 or 4 hours, but there is no limitation in the order, and, of course, that's not guaranteed at all.
But none of that makes any difference. I mean, the essential fight is whether or not the court abused its discretion in not quashing this deposition.
That is my position. The trial court also orders Mr. Rosenberg personally to produce documents. That is no longer directly at issue in this case because, as you can see by the March 21st supplemental response, they have now withdrawn the subpoena deuces tecum. Nevertheless, I think the subpoena deuces tecum is still relevant in determining the first issue of whether the deposition is proper at all, because I believe it illustrates that the motivation for this discovery was improper. There's no reason to order the CEO to personally produce documents. They can always be obtained by less onerous means.
You have, I believe it's been in one of the briefs, actually in the amicus brief has been here, but there has been a suggestion in your brief that of the test that you think we should adopt in what has become known as like apex depositions. One of them is that, well, let me start with, do you think every witness who is received a notice of deposition should have as a threshold the opportunity to file an affidavit saying that they have no personal knowledge of any relevant facts? Should every witness, every individual given a subpoena for a deposition, have the ability to submit an affidavit to the court saying they have no knowledge of relevant facts?
Well, I think under Rule 166B, there is an initial threshold with regard to any discovery, and that is that it has to be reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence.
And counsel has to take the witness's word for it?
No.
Without knowing what the questions are, that they have no knowledge of the answers of any of the questions that might be asked?
No, I don't think the court has to take the witness's word for it. And that is why, in an ordinary witness's case, his affidavit that he has no personal knowledge is certainly not going to be conclusive. But one of the things that's pointed out, I'm sorry.
Okay, but let's assume that witness has done so. What do you say is the next step the court should take?
The next step the court should take, obviously there would be a response, and there would be some showing by the party seeking to take the deposition of why this is reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence.
I have a couple of questions, and I don't mean to be interrupting your argument, but
no, go ahead.
I'm trying to go through these elements. Assuming that any witness can file an affidavit saying, hey, I don't know anything about this case, then what you're saying the next step would be for the party wants to take the deposition to make some sort of showing of relevance to what they might glean from their testimony?
Yes.
Okay. Do you say this should be applicable in every case?
Yes, I think it should. I think that how you apply that test varies in different cases. That's one of the things that's pointed out in cases like Liberty Mutual versus Superior Court. When you have somebody like a CEO who is many levels up the corporation and who ordinarily would have no involvement with ordinary day-to-day operations, it's not implausible for him to come forward in an affidavit and say, I wasn't involved in this. I had no relevant knowledge. If you have somebody much lower down, the safety director, who comes up with an affidavit and says, I have no knowledge, the affidavit is per se implausible. So how the trial court is going to weigh that, I think, definitely varies in other cases. The problem with CEOs is, first of all, as a general matter, they do not have specific knowledge of individual cases.
Would you require them to have specific knowledge?
Yes, I would require
them. What
are
the conditions would you impose before you could take a deposition of a CEO?
I would adopt the two-prong test that Justices Hecht and Gonzalez suggested in Monsanto versus May, which I think is the same as the California court adopted in Liberty Mutual versus Superior Court. And it's a two-prong test. First of all, there has to be a reasonable showing that the CEO has some relevant knowledge. And I would submit that showing in the case of the CEO needs to be reasonably specific. It's not enough to come forward and say, well, gee, he's been the CEO for a long time, and therefore he must know something. And if you look at the trial court's second order in this case, where she sets out the reasons for the order, that's precisely what she relies on, is he was the CEO and he was involved in policymaking decisions. Well, that describes every CEO. There is nothing in the order, nothing in the record that indicates that he has any knowledge related to any asbestos matters at the refinery in Pasadena. He's not even headquartered here. He works in Baltimore. I think the showing that needs to be made is, here's something that indicates he was involved with regard to asbestos matters. Here's a document that he wrote, or here's documents from the safety department that were copied to him, or something that indicates he actually has some specific or unique knowledge that can't be gleaned elsewhere.
And this would be a test applicable only to the CEO, or would this also apply to other individuals in the corporate hierarchy?
I think this test applies most strongly to the CEO. I think other very high-level officers, it could also apply to. The problem here is not that these people are important or immune from the rules of discovery or anything like that. The problem is that they are uniquely vulnerable to this kind of harassment.
Even, and you're saying that the other sanctions under Rule 215 are inadequate to police the abuses?
Yes, they are. This is not something that can be remedied by sanctions or by appeal. Even medium-sized corporations may have hundreds of lawsuits, and if these people are deposed in even a fraction of them, say 10 lawsuits a year, one day to prepare, one day to take the deposition, that's 20 working days out of his schedule, a full month gone. You can't remedy that by appeal. You can't compensate the corporation for it by paying their attorney's fees. That's not the issue, and that's not the kind of harm that we're concerned with here.
But as I understand it, you're not seeking to ban CEO depositions.
No, right? I'm not.
You want to make sure that they take other depositions and do other discovery first.
Correct, and that's why this...
Why doesn't that just compound discovery problems by expanding the amount of discovery that will be undertaken? If a litigant is determined to eventually take the CEO's deposition, why would we require them to take other depositions before then, unless you're seeking to ban CEO depositions altogether?
No, and that's why this case really is not about a party's right to obtain relevant information to his case, but rather it's about the methods that the parties have to use to acquire that information. If what we are seeking to have them do is take depositions of people who were involved in the case and who do have direct knowledge. And in many cases, I think that's going to obviate the need for the CEO's deposition. And I think that in many cases, a trial court can find that they got the information they needed from other depositions and other forms of discovery, and that the CEO's deposition is unnecessary and cumulative.
Isn't the guidance a really relevant knowledge? You're entitled to depose the CEO if he has relevant knowledge, if he doesn't or not. Isn't that the real thrust of what the test is?
I think so, and that is ultimately just an application of the way the rules are. The cases like General Motors versus Lawrence and Walker versus Packard, there's a Wright comment, I think, in General Motors versus Lawrence about how ordering discovery of non-relevant evidence is not a sanction that our rules contemplate. And I think that's a basic threshold for discovery. He has to have relevant knowledge. And if there's somebody with greater knowledge, go there first, and you may not need it at all.
That concerns me, because in one part of the brief there's a comment that really you're telling the plaintiff, go to somebody who has more knowledge than us. Let's talk about this reasonable indication of the officer's personal knowledge of underlying facts. What would a plaintiff who, or a defendant, who wants to take the other side's deposition, and the person who receives the notice files an affidavit, I have no knowledge of personal, and I have no personal knowledge of relevant facts. Then you say that should, at that point, there should not be a deposition unless the party who's requesting deposition comes forward to the court and presents a reasonable indication of that personal knowledge. What is the standard of review? I mean, what do we look at to determine that the individual who wants to take the deposition has met the standard of demonstrating a reasonable indication of personal knowledge?
Well, I think that if there are disputed fact issues about the level of knowledge, that the trial court is going to have a lot of discretion. In this case, there really is no, there's nothing to dispute Mr. Rosenberg's affidavit.
Well, let me ask you this. The plaintiff, the real party in interest, makes the claim that there were decisions made with respect to the continued manufacturing and use of asbestos after the president of the company learned and was aware of the dangers of asbestos. And then they say, we took the deposition of one individual who said all these decisions went up the chain of command, and ultimately Mr. Rosenberg would be a part of this decision-making process. Your being here today indicates that you do not believe that that is a reasonable indication of the officer's personal knowledge about the continued manufacturing use of the asbestos, discounting for a moment that the president would walk through the company and see how it's being operated. What do you say should have been what standard they're required to meet?
Well, first of all, I don't think that those are the facts in this case. I don't think they have any evidence like that. Let me give you an example. They rely on the deposition of Glenn Price as one of the people who mentioned Mr. Rosenberg, and he was asked how were the decisions made related to asbestos in the Crown Central Refinery when this issue first came up. And what he said is, I feel like that the operations superintendent got hold of the information and went to the plant manager, who then went to the vice president, and with the cooperation of the safety department, the procedures came out for the handling of it. He never mentioned Mr. Rosenberg at all, and the operations superintendent, the plant manager, and the vice president have not been deposed. Now, if those people had been deposed and said, oh yes, we were in liaison with Mr. Rosenberg in making these decisions, then certainly Mr. Rosenberg at that point is relevant. I think it would still be appropriate to take those people's depositions first, and it may obviate the need for Mr. Rosenberg's deposition. But there is no indication on this record that Mr. Rosenberg actually has personal knowledge. After this question was asked, the next thing that happened was they started taking the witness through the corporate hierarchy, which of course eventually led to the CEO. But when they asked what would the vice president have done with this information, the witness said, I don't know. I suspect it may have gone up to the CEO. But mere suspicion or surmise is no evidence. Anything could have gone to the CEO.
Any other questions?
Mr. Carnegie, this, the rule you are proposing, would this apply to commercial litigation where there are corporations on either side of the docket?
Absolutely.
And it, so it would not just apply to personal injury litigation?
That's right. This is not a special rule for personal injury litigation at all. It's not a special rule for plaintiffs or defendants. I think it should apply across the board.
So before two large corporations, two big insurance companies could take the depositions, say they were suing each other on a coverage matter, an excess carrier, a primary carrier, there'd have to be an affidavit filed showing what knowledge that the litigant thought that the CEO of the opposing corporation had before that deposition could take place, or multiple other depositions taken as a predicate to that?
I think in many cases, I mean, for example, if you've got a big proxy fight or you've got a takeover battle, then it's very obvious the CEO is going to be deposed. And when that's noticed, I don't think you're going to get the process where the CEO files an affidavit and says, I don't know anything about this. I think in ordinary run-of-the-mill commercial matters, the CEO is probably not going to be any more involved than he is in an ordinary slip and fall or than Rosenberg was in this asbestos case. But yes, I think it should apply to all kinds of cases.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready for argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Cavett will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. I have listened with great interest to the opening argument to the opposing counsel because as I read his briefs, what I read was a request by this court to make a special rule for the CEO of Crown Central. Under the court's questioning, I heard a substantial retreat. What I heard counsel saying to this court under the court's questioning was, no, we recognize that the problem should be solved within the framework of the rules and that the rules should apply to everyone. Now, if that's really where we are, then counsel, opposing counsel, and I don't have a great deal of disagreement about the status of the law. I pondered for some time the best way to open this presentation, and it wasn't what I just said, I might add. But I finally went back to, as I found always is the best way to solve a problem, I went back to the basics. What are we dealing with? We're dealing with a problem covered by the rules of civil procedure. What do the rules of civil procedure say? Well, they say three things. Rule 200 says the litigants may take the deposition of, quote, in part. Rule 200 is tempered by Rule 166B, which says you may discover relevant information. Does not have to be admissible information.
Mr. Cavett, what means of discovery had you used in this case prior to asking for the CEO's deposition?
Justice Hightower, I'm glad you asked that, and I want to confess to a failing on my part. I did not realize until a couple of days ago that all of the discovery was not before this court. I had made an assumption that it was in the evidence that the relator had filed or that were otherwise before the court, and I discovered that it was not. Late last night by Federal Express, I sent to this court a second supplemental brief and exhibits, and it arrived sometime this morning, I'm sure. Also sent a copy to the opposing counsel because he may or may not have received it yet. In those supplemental exhibits, I included all of the paper discovery as well as the cover pages from the depositions and a couple of pages from one of the depositions that I think is relevant. Here's where we are on the discovery. We have the parties, both parties together, have taken a total of 12 depositions. We have deposed four of the plant officials at the managerial level capacity positions, a nurse, a shift supervisor, some folks like that. We have served on Crown Central a total of 118 interrogatories and a total of 73 requests for production. I wanted you to see those, and I would ask you to look at those, because from all of that work, the paper discovery, we have received almost nothing, almost nothing. Let me give you a couple of examples. in the supplemental brief filed by Crown Central, they say, well, if nothing else, they ought to be required, they being the plaintiffs, to take the depositions of the plant managers. Interrogatory number 3 from our first set of interrogatories over a year ago, we said, please identify and give the address and telephone numbers for all plant managers. Answer, objection, overly broad, harassing, burdensome, relevancy. The request of plant managers at all facilities for the past 40 years is not relevant, nor reasonably calculated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, they only had one refinery during this time period, so all facilities is a little bit of red herring. They close by saying, we will, if we can find it, furnish you the names of the managers of the Pasadena refinery over a year ago. That's never been done. But they argue to this court that we haven't exhausted less intrusive means of discovery. The same thing is true with our request for the personnel in the safety departments, objection, overbroad, et cetera, et cetera. If we can find it, we'll furnish it. A year ago we requested, never been furnished. Environmental engineers, we asked for the names of their environmental engineers. Again, during the time period in question, which is 1941 to 1981, which is the time when Mr. Carr worked in that refinery. Objection, same objections. We'll supplement if we can find it. Again, they didn't give it to us. That's the pattern throughout.
Why isn't the remedy for that, though, to compel that discovery rather than take other depositions as is proposed here?
Well, the first problem I have with that, Your Honor, is why should we have to do that? We have asked for it. They are not willing to furnish it. We have other information that would indicate that this particular CEO has some of the knowledge that we've been asking in barring those interrogatories that they have.
Well, one explanation is that you don't want it to escalate like that simply by saying, give us the world, no, okay, and give us your CEO. And we really haven't accomplished much by that hardball kind of litigation tactic that goes on fairly frequently.
Yes, it does. And one of the problems with a case like this is that everything is situational, everything. Shifts and turns and is there.
What unique knowledge or information do you believe that this CEO has that is relevant and necessary to your cause of action?
Here's the problem in this lawsuit. Mr. Carr worked at that refinery from 1941 through 1981. Most of the executive personnel, I'm sorry, most of the people he worked with are no longer in the refinery, particularly managerial level people, because by the time you reach a managerial level, you're at an age where you're going to retire before too many years in most instances. So we don't have a whole lot of people we can even look to begin with. And specifically with executive level personnel, we have only Mr. Rosenberg. He's the only one still on the job who was a top or high level, not top level, but high level executive during the years that Mr. Carr was there. Now here's why that's important. Our development of the evidence has indicated, A, that there was a lot of asbestos in this refinery, B, that it was left in the refinery for a long period of time after a reasonable person would have known that it should have been taken out, and C, when it was taken out, the methods we have questions about also. So we are working from that standpoint. Now, we've got to show, as one of our elements of proof, that there were some policy decisions made to do these particular things. That created the condition that caused Mr. Carr's death. Well, the only way to show those ultimately is to get the information from the top level executive decision makers. Now, if we had, when this lawsuit was filed, if the first or second or third thing we had done was issue a subpoena to depose Mr. Rosenberg, I think it should have been quashed because we hadn't done anything to determine where the level of responsibility might be or where we might get the information. But at this point, we have a witness, managerial level witness, saying, here's how this problem was handled when they discovered asbestos, and then say, and I certainly don't agree with counsel's characterization of this testimony, after they talked about the various things that were done to try to solve this asbestos problem, and he's talking about where the decision-making process went. We get it to Fred Otto, who was a fairly high-level managerial person. Says, and then what would Fred Otto have done with that information? Witness says, I really don't know. I suspect what he'd done was he would carry it on up the corporation to the chief executive officer, and they would discuss what needed to be, what we needed to do about it, and then it would come back down the line, and the action would be taken. Question.
Other than that testimony, is there any other indication that the CEO was involved in any policy decisions or had any knowledge at all about the handling of asbestos containing material?
Only from the standpoint of two other things, his position over this period of time as the CEO. Because we're talking, you know, we're not talking about a $10 job, we're talking about a major renovation of the refinery if you go ahead and take all this asbestos out. This being the only refinery the company had, I don't think there's any question that he would have been in on the decision making. So,
do you have the evidence that other than this deposition testimony?
No.
Any documents, anything?
No, we don't. But of course, we haven't been given the documents. And that's the same problem that I was just talking about. We ask for all sorts of documents like that, and those are also in those supplemental exhibits I file. And again, we get objection, too many, we can't find them, we don't know where they are, we'll furnish them if we can find them, we never got them. But
has Mr. Rosenberg been in this CEO position through most of this time, or did he promote up through the ranks?
He started very high, Your Honor. His family has owned a big chunk of this refinery for many, many years. He's been on the board of directors since 1955. Exhibit 19 to our first set of exhibits indicates a lot of that background information. He's 63 years old, director since 1955, chairman of the board.
During the years that some of these decisions were made, he was on the board, although he may not have been CEO.
Right, he became CEO in 75. And it was in the early 70s that even the company acknowledges that it knew about the asbestos or learned about it. So it was in the 70s, mid-70s perhaps, that the decisions were made. There certainly is an indication that he was there at the time and would have been in a position to have made a lot of these decisions.
Mr. Counts, you do concede, don't you, that there is some potential for abuse of CEO depositions, for example, in a slip and fall case where it's just done for harassment or to try to force nuisance value settlements?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how would you propose that those be addressed?
Well, you go right back to the rules. If someone is noticed to appear for a deposition and they say, I have no knowledge of any event that is relevant to this lawsuit, then they file a motion saying that. Now, I would disagree with counsel as to where the burden is. I think if that's what I'm saying, then it's my burden to prove it. And I think I ought to have to get on the witness stand under oath and face cross-examination and prove that I did not know it to the
side. So the way to avoid a deposition is, if they're being used for harassment, is to get on the witness stand in front of the judge and be cross-examined?
Well, otherwise we're going to have the battle of the affidavits. That's an alternative. But I don't like battles of affidavits for a lot of reasons, although I like the affidavit in this case, and I'm going to tell you why in just a second. But however we do it, and that's something for this court eventually to decide, either the rulemaking process or case law. However we do it, the burden should be on the person saying they have no knowledge to prove it, to provide real evidence in some form that they don't have any knowledge. If that can be countered with evidence that they do, then the trial judge is satisfied. The trial judge is going to make a fact finding. If there can be no showing that the person to be deposed has no knowledge of anything relevant to the case, then I don't think they ought to be deposed, because then he does become harassment. I certainly agree with that.
The amici suggest that that's part of what is attempted to be shown in deposing high-level executives, that it's a no-win situation. Either you do know and you didn't do anything about it, or you don't know and you don't care. And the argument is that takes advantage of a particular vulnerability in an organizational structure where it is impossible for people at the top to know everything, and yet they can be portrayed, if they don't know everything, as not caring. Don't those tactics drive a lot of these depositions?
I can't speak for others. It's not driving this one. But the test that we're talking about here would solve that, in that if the showing is that the person has no knowledge, they don't get deposed. So you don't get into that you don't know but you didn't care. If there's a showing they do have knowledge, then they are deposed, and that is relevant. The jury's entitled to know. If Mr. Rosenberg knew, as we suspect, prior to 1970 that this asbestos was a deadly product, and that he and perhaps others made a conscious decision to leave it in this refinery to the detriment of the health of the workers because it costs too much to change it all out. That's something that we are entitled to know, something that jury is entitled to know.
But is there any indication that that's the case other than this passage in the deposition? Any other evidence that leads you to believe that that was in fact the case?
Not in direct evidence, no, but let me say one other thing about this, and I want to go back to his affidavit also. At this point, we don't have to have admissible evidence. The test is not, do we have admissible evidence that he did something he shouldn't have done, or that we have somebody take his deposition? The test is whether there's something reasonably reliable that would indicate that he has some knowledge. Well, we have a managerial level employee talking about the chain of command and the way things are bounced up and down. Now, it's true that he has some disclaimers, and I don't know, and I'm not sure about this, but he wouldn't have just out of the air said, oh, well, you know, here's what happened.
Have you talked to anybody else in the chain of command to find out how far anything went?
No, and most of those names we have not been able to get because we've requested all sorts of managerial people, and we've gotten that information that I was reading to you a few minutes ago. But let me say a couple of things about Mr. Rosenberg's affidavit. Knowing what this witness had said about how it was bounced up and down the chain.
Wait, let's make it clear. Who is this witness? What is his position?
His name is Price. He was a shift manager. He was in control, as I understand the various designations, of all the men on a particular work shift at the refinery. Now, if the court wishes to see the exact information, I'll be happy to provide.
He was not an officer?
No, he is not an executive officer, no.
He's not an officer at all, is he?
I guess it depends on how you define officer, but I suppose not. I don't know what you mean by officer, but he would not have been considered an executive as the world in general considers business executives. He was a shift manager. But that's considered managerial level post. Now, let me say,
if you had made a motion for sanctions to get some kind of compliance with your previous request, which had been turned down by the court below, wouldn't you stand in a little stronger position here today?
Probably. But it seems to me terribly unfair to say that when we've done everything we should do.
Which was made the information request.
Right. And it's information we're clearly entitled to. When we have done that and we don't get it, and then we try to take a deposition, they say, oh, well, you don't know these things and you haven't done these things, and it's because they won't give us the information. That's got to be a factor in there. I grant you that, and when I started looking at this, you know, my thought was it would have been nice if we had gone ahead and done that because it just strengthens our position. But I keep trying to get to Mr. Rosenberg's definition.
But before you move on, we'll give you time to do that. But you identified a person by the name of Otto, high in the chain of command. Has he been deposed?
I don't think so.
Have you made any effort to depose him?
I'm sorry?
You have not made any effort to depose him?
My understanding is that he's retired. Now, I say that with qualifications.
Whether he retired or not, is the answer no?
That's correct. We have not deposed him. Mr. Rosenberg's affidavit was made knowing about that testimony and knowing about the other things that we set out in our briefs about why we think he has knowledge. Look at his affidavit. See if you see in there a single word where he denies being involved in policy-level decisions about the handling of asbestos. Not one word. He has not joined issue on the very question before this court. He has not said one time, I have nothing to do with these policy-level decisions. And he made that affidavit knowing that we were in the courthouse saying, Mr. Rosenberg, we think that these questions were bounced up to you and that you made the decision that we won't ask you about. Now, whatever test you apply, however you construct it, I think you have got to say that the very item parties are seeking must be denied by the person to be deposed or in some manner negated before there's even an issue to be decided in that person's favor. And that's not been done in this case.
I'm sorry, I'm not clear. Saying they need to deny what?
Well,
before
what we have made clear all along is that we are trying to take his deposition to find out what his role was in these policy decisions. and he did not deny that he had a role in the policy decision-making process. So I guess I'm not saying it very well, but what I'm trying to say is that the party saying, I have no knowledge, what the federal court calls a know-nothing affidavit, I have no knowledge, should be required to direct that lack of knowledge in some way, or to say something to indicate that the thing you're trying to get from that person doesn't know. Now, even a generic statement, I have no knowledge about any of the things in question in this case, might get you there, or at least might be some kind of confirmation case. Mr. Rosenberg doesn't even do that. He denies certain things, but he does not deny having knowledge or participating in the policy decisions that were pertinent at the key times in this case.
So if he did make such an affidavit, then you would not be allowed to take his deposition?
Well, I think we'd be allowed to have a hearing on it and determine whether we had more enough to convince the trial court that we should be able to.
At which he would have to testify?
I think he should have to testify. Again, that gets into a rulemaking problem, I think, as much as anything else that only this court can solve.
Mr. Counters, assuming that you are entitled to make discovery of items that will lead to admissible evidence, and the other side objects, saying this stuff is not going to lead to admissible evidence, wouldn't you have the burden of persuasion to come forward and establish how it's going to lead to admissible evidence?
I would hope that the court would not go in that direction, because we operate, all of our litigation system operates from the standpoint that the person saying you can't do something has to in some manner prove it. Now, at the very least, there should be, as I think was suggested by, well, I know it was suggested, Justice Gonzalez's dissent in Monsanto, an affidavit saying, I don't know anything about this. I mean, that should be at least a starting point. And if that's enough to satisfy the prima facie burden, then it's enough. I would hope it would be more than that, but at the very least, there should be something under oath, subject to the penalty of perjury, by which this person takes the position that they don't know anything about the very thing that you're trying to depose them about in a particular case. I don't see how it can work any other way. If you don't have that kind of rule, then every potential witness simply runs in, files a motion, says, I don't know anything about it, and then you've got to stop what you're doing. Go down to the courthouse, show why that person should be deposed.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Kevin.
Initially, I disagree with the characterization of the discovery that's taken place today. Yes, we've objected to discovery, but, for example, virtually all of Crown Central's documents have been produced. Plaintiffs don't believe that because there really are not a huge volume of them. But pursuant to the objections that we filed, a very small quantity of documents has been withheld. And out of the documents that have been produced, they don't have a single one with Mr. Rosenberg's name on it, other than the form letter relating to a strike in 1980.
Can you address, Mr. Carnegie, why this court should grant a writ of mandamus, an extraordinary writ in a case like this, and how we can somehow limit our intervention in the trial court's discovery decisions on a, or what I'm concerned about is, my question suggests, is if we grant the relief that you're asking for, where are we going to stop?
I think the court needs to grant the relief I'm asking for and establish a test, and I think that will stop the writs of mandamus to this court, or at least in large part. This is the fifth time this issue has come up to this court. I think the trial courts desperately need some guidance on this issue. As to the propriety of a writ of mandamus, I think Walker versus Packer and cases like General Motors versus Lawrence are very supportive of granting a writ like this. Walker versus Packer points out, talking about no remedy by appeal, that no remedy by appeal occurs where a discovery order compels the production of patently irrelevant or duplicative documents such that it clearly constitutes harassment or imposes a burden on the producing party far out of proportion of any benefit that may obtain to the requesting party.
That prompts my next question. You said earlier that the CEO would not be immunized from giving
his or her deposition at some later point, that you would merely ask that they start lower in the, on the corporate ladder and then work their way up, and you say that many times they'll be satisfied with what they get before they get to the CEO. But you concede that if they're not, that at some point they would be entitled to the CEO deposition if they go through the intermediate steps you suggest.
Yes, if there is some showing that the CEO actually has some relevant, hopefully non-cumulative knowledge that they haven't been able to get elsewhere. That hasn't occurred in this case. There are four depositions taken, and every reference to Mr. Rosenberg in those depositions is in this record.
Let's talk about this. I asked earlier about the test. We've assumed that any party that gets served with a nose-tech deposition can file an affidavit and say, I have no knowledge. Your view of how this test would operate is then the party wanting to take position must come forward and, one, show reasonable indication of their personal knowledge. Now, what do you consider would meet this, or the threshold of a reasonable indication of personal knowledge of underlying facts?
Well, I think the showing is probably lower if you're talking about a lower level employee who's more likely to have direct involvement. Where you're talking about a CEO who you wouldn't expect to have any direct involvement, I think it needs to be a fairly, not only a CEO who you wouldn't expect to have direct involvement, but a CEO who is particularly vulnerable and where the damage that can be done to the corporation by this process is very great. I think the showing needs to be a little higher. I think it needs to be...
Let me stop you right there. Do we have any information in our record of just how big Crown Corporation, Crown Central is?
Yes. Crown Central employs over 3,000 employees at any given time.
Okay. If Crown employed only 300 employees, would the standard of reasonableness of relevant information be different?
I think what you get to is where a corporation gets down to a certain size. You know, if you're a 15-man shop, the CEO is probably going to be directly involved in everything. If you're 300, less so. If you're 3,000, less so. If you're 3 million, even less so. So I think that's something that's probably taken into account in the weighing process. That's also taken into account in considering the damage that can be done to the corporation. If you're a 15-man shop, you probably don't have 100 lawsuits, and the CEO's not in danger of getting deposed twice a week.
But arguably, if you have a 15-man shop and you are a hands-on individual, one deposition that lasts a week could be devastating to your company. Whereas the CEO of a 3-million-man shop, the deposition taking up 6 months might not be damaging.
Well, I think if you're a large corporation, deposition of a CEO like that certainly would be damaging. But I also agree that in a small corporation, a long deposition could also be damaging. That should certainly be taken into account. The difference is that in a very small corporation, the CEO is much more likely to have direct personal knowledge and be directly involved. On this record, we have absolutely nothing indicating direct involvement. Out of all the documents that have been produced, not one has his name on it, except the form letter relating to the strike. Out of all four depositions, he's mentioned only in two of them. None of them indicate that he actually has direct personal knowledge. In the other two depositions, he's not mentioned at all. There's nothing here.
Why doesn't the affidavit disavow knowledge of policy matters relating to asbestos?
I think that it does. He says that I have no knowledge of Mr. Rosenberg's asbestos exposure. I have no expertise in asbestos or toxicology or anything like that. So I think that the affidavit is plenty adequate to disavow knowledge.
Mr. Carnegie, you have suggested that the plaintiff ought to work their way up the deposition chain to get the information. Yet, if I understand, the attempt to discover the names and addresses of people in that chain who might possibly be deposed has been denied.
I don't think that's accurate. I mean, first of all, I would say that if it was accurate and if there are unfounded objections, then what they should be doing is moving to compel and saying we need these names. But in fact, they do have the names. For example, in Glenn Price's deposition, They named the operations manager. They named the plant manager, Jim Nowell, Jim Robinson, if I'm correct. They named the vice president.
Fred Otto.
Have those people been deposed?
Pardon me?
Have those people been deposed?
No, none of those people have been deposed. And I think that shows what's really intended by this discovery. They come forward with Glenn Price's deposition, who says, I don't know if the CEO was involved, and they say, this justifies us taking the CEO's deposition. But then the people that he mentioned as being directly involved, the plant manager, the operations manager, and the vice president, they've completely bypassed and haven't deposed at all. Surely those people, that deposition does show, really were involved. And those are the people they should be deposing first. Those are the people who have direct knowledge. And if they do that, I'll bet what you find, if they ask those people, was Rosenberg involved in this? They say no. And their knowledge can give the plaintiffs what they need to prosecute the case. And it's my contention that's what should have been done here, and that's the way this process should work.
Any other questions?
This is just one last question. Mr. Carney, as I understand your concern, and the concern generally that was expressed in the dissent that was filed in the Monsanto case, the denial of the writ, one of the large concerns is harassment and multiple depositions being taken of the CEO where they don't really know very much, if anything, and they're harassing the capability for harassment. Can you tell us, is it in the record here, how many times Mr. Rosenberg's deposition has been sought in the year prior to this deposition or in the last 5 years, or how many times it had been taken?
I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you that he has been deposed before. I don't know how many times that it's been noticed.
Should that be part of the proof that the CEO should have to make in order to show the harassment at the trial court level in order to avoid the deposition being taken? Or are you saying that any time an affidavit is filed that says, I don't know anything about this, that ought to satisfy the CEO's burden?
I'm saying the latter. I think that what we see here is that this issue of CEO depositions is something that's becoming endemic. That's why this is the fifth time this issue has been presented to this court. It's an issue that's very important with corporations around the country, as I think is shown by the amicus briefs filed both in this case and in the earlier Monsanto case.
So you would classify any time a CEO deposition is noticed where the CEO files an affidavit and says, I don't know anything, that is in and of itself harassment?
Yes, because otherwise what you end up with is you would end up with a test where the CEO would have to be deposed a bunch of times before he could come over and say, wait a minute, I'm being harassed. And so in the first four cases where it happened, it's okay, but now in the fifth case, it's not. The problem here is with the potential for this to happen to CEOs of corporations.
But if we accept what you say, that this rule applies across the board, the threshold is relevance or likely lead to relevant evidence, and so the mere filing of an affidavit by any witness that I have no knowledge of personal facts puts, by our rule as it exists, puts the person requesting deposition to the burden of establishing nominal relevance. And if that were the case, it would be immaterial whether the CEO had lots of subpoenaed depositions or none, as long as a person requesting deposition had to meet the threshold test of relevance in the face of the affidavit, that would satisfy your concerns.
That would satisfy part of the concerns, but I'm very concerned with the application of this test because...
But then you say it's just simply a balancing test after that. At that point, it becomes a balancing test, in which event you would consider how often this CEO has his deposition taken and how likely it is that it's going to be more important for him to testify than others to testify first and that sort of thing. That would play in the balancing test, not at the threshold.
I think that the way that the balancing test should be done is, first of all, you have to establish the threshold that he has some relevant knowledge. And second, the second part of the balancing test is, are there less burdensome, less onerous means to get this information? Have they deposed the plant manager, the operations manager, the vice president who was directly involved? And if not, why not? And what do they think they can get from this CEO that they can't get from those people? Why is it necessary
to do this by the most onerous, burdensome, inefficient means that you can do it when you have an efficient, direct way to go about it. Isn't that what the rules contemplate? Isn't that the way it should be done? And then if they do that, if they take those depositions and they can't get some information or they don't know, then they come forward and they say, you know, we've done this. We can't get the information. It's not there. Here's who we proposed. Here's what information we haven't been able to get. We need to take the CEO's deposition. Then, of course, we can take it.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kim. That concludes the argument of the second cause. The court will take another brief recess.